If a pollster or a census taker had visited any of the communities in the Holy Land during the Middle Ages and had asked the heads of the households there to list their occupation, he would have found that by far the largest number would have answered piety. Now, piety doesn't pay well. These people, for the most part, spent their days in prayer and in study, holy occupations of Jewish life. They did so because they felt that through their prayers and their study of Torah in the Holy Land, they were hastening the end of the exile and the coming of the Messiah. Some were called the Avnei Tzion, the mourners for Zion. All of them felt that they, by being in the Holy Land, which is the highest place on earth, closest to God, they were a key element in the pious life, the life of piety of the Jewish people in terms of encouraging God to bring redemption. But still, even holy men have to put some food in their stomachs. And since Jewish holy men marry, and marriages tend to lead to children, their wives and their children had to be fed also. So how did piety resolve this problem in the Middle Ages? They had what was known as a kolel. Kolel is a word which simply means a centralized fundraising agency. And what the kolel did was to send out from Hebron or Tiberias or Jerusalem or Sfat missionaries, schnorrers. They were called shlichim. And each one was given a territory. Essentially, they were commission salesmen. Commission salesmen in piety. And one was given Lodz and its environs, and one was given Marrakesh and its environs, and one was given Bombay and its environs. And they would leave from the Holy Land, and they would be given a commission paper, which certified that they were collecting funds for the Holy Kolel, and then they would pass through their territory, and the usual arrangement was that they would be able to pocket 50% of the monies that they raised, plus their expenses, and the rest of the money would, in one way or another, be remitted to the Kolel for distribution to the professional pious. And believe it or not, somehow it worked. Because there's very little evidence that unless the locals attacked these communities, they starved. Now, the profit motive is a powerful one, as we well recognize. And since these salesmen were working on commission, it's really quite amazing when you read the stories of the shlichim. They literally crossed the seven seas and the highest mountains in order to raise money. And my favorite story of one of these shlichim has to do with the brave soul who found himself in England, and he heard in the early part of the 18th century, and he heard that a new unharvested field of fairly rich Jews had developed in Newport, in Rhode Island. So he bought passage on one of the little ships of the time, and he landed in New York. And he made his way to Newport, and he harvested such gold as he could from the Jews of Newport. But after he had paid his expenses, it wasn't enough for a return ticket back to Europe. So here he was, high and dry and Puritan in New England. So what does a shliach, a schnorrer, do who's high and dry and Puritan New England? Believe me, Puritan New England was high and dry. He puts his ear to the ground, and he discovers that a local divine by the name of Ezra Stiles was about to found a new cemetery, which he was going to call Yale. And so he hied himself to Hartford, where Ezra Stile was preaching at the time. And he told Ezra Stile that he was a biblical scholar. And since, in fact, he knew Hebrew, and Ezra Stiles hadn't the faintest idea what Hebrew looked like or sounded like, he gained an appointment as the first academic Jew to gain an academic chair in an American university. Now, the most ingenious of all of these commission salesmen in piety, all these representatives of the Kollel, was an unknown genius who went into Eastern Europe, probably in the 15th to 16th century, and recognized that in order to make money, you sometimes have to spend some money. And he did a little bit of investigation. His territory was relatively poor. And he recognized that though people were pious and were willing to give him whatever free money they had when he happened to show up in town, they didn't know when he would come. They certainly didn't save for his coming because their lives were desperate and they lived on a thin edge. And so the problem, he decided, was that he couldn't be everywhere at the same time always, but he could, he decided, leave behind a cash box, a place in which they could put money. And so he went to a manufacturer friend of his, and he asked the manufacturer to build him little collection boxes. And this man built him a set of little blue boxes with a little place in the top where you could drop in the coins. And then this representative Kollel put across the face of the box, Meir Baal HaNes, Meir, the master of miracles. And wherever he went, he left little boxes behind him. And sure enough, the housewife, husband, the children, from time to time, whenever they wanted something desperately, because you always, in a sense, give a little money with prayer, they would drop coin in the box. And now he was a real collection agent. He'd simply come through town and pick up the boxes and give a receipt for what was there. And he doubled and tripled and quadrupled his income very nicely. Now, these little blue boxes, which began in Poland, picked up the Polish name Puszka. And in the 19th century, the Zionists revised this old form of piety. And many of you may remember in your home or your parents' home, because almost every Jewish home had one, a little blue box made out of some kind of simple metal with a white map of the Holy Land on it. It was called Palestine at the time. And it was titled not Meir Baal HaNes now, but Keren Kayemet Lisrael, the Jewish National Fund. And the monies that were collected in these boxes were really the major funds which bought land in Palestine between 1890 and the 1920s and 30s. And again, collection agents, better police this time, went out through all of Europe and America collecting these boxes. And this old piety became a modern form of charity, which really went out of business only in our own lifetime, as federations and the UJA and other more efficient fundraising agencies took their place. Now, why was this name Meir Baal HaNes such an attractive one to put on the boxes? Well, why should people associate prayer in the first instance with giving it money? They do. It seems to be universal. If you go into Asia, and you go to any of the Buddhist temples, the Hindu temples, Shinto temples, you'll find that before the shrine where the images sit, there's always a great big wooden box. And as the person makes his prayer, he'll clap his hands together and then toss a penny, whatever little sum he has, into that box. In part, it has to do with the custom of the world, which was that when you had a need in human terms, you had to go to your lord and your master. You didn't go directly. You went to court. You found a bureaucrat, a courtier. You paid him a sum of money, and he interceded for you with the Lord, and the heavenly court was supposed to operate just as the earthly court, in fact, did. I suspect also it had to do with a proof of your own need, your own earning. You were willing to give something, you sacrificed something to the God, and that very statement of need might, in fact, that you had given something for this that you so desperately needed, might suggest to the God that she be merciful to you. Now, Meir Baal HaNes turns out to be one of the most enigmatic of holy saints that you can possibly imagine. I told you the other day of the Muslim story about the poor man who had nothing left, who had run through whatever his business, and he had nothing left but his donkey, his ass, and how he and the donkey went out to find their way, to make their fortune in the world. The donkey died, and how when he lay prostrate over the grave, you know, passers-by saw him, felt that this must be the grave of some holy man. They began to leave money with their prayers, and suddenly he was in business. Well, there's a certain amount of that to this Meir Baal HaNes story. If you go to Tiberias, and we've gotten there, if you go to Tiberias today, your guide will show you on the hillside just above, just outside the town, a collection of small buildings, several of them having these small little domes on them, which is the Beit Midrashah, sanctuary, the school associated with Meir Baal HaNes, Meir, the master of the miracles. And he will tell you that a great holy man lies here and that miracle cures occur here. People come here who are pious to offer their prayers. They've lost an article. They think they'll learn here where it has been lost. They're afraid of childbirth. Whatever the need, they come and express it. He'll probably tell you that this is the gravesite of a very important second century Tana, second century religious leader by the name of Meir. Meir is one of the men who's quoted most often in the Mishnah. In fact, we believe that he was the man who first organized the material of the Mishnah in the form in which it was finally edited. He's a very important sage of the first half of the second century. And his name is Meir. And so his name got associated with this Meir Baal HaNes shrine. What he will not tell you, this Israeli guide, is the Talmud indicates that Meir died in Turkey. But that's another story. Fact and piety are not always necessarily wedded. In the Middle Ages, they associated this shrine, we don't know how it came into being, with a man by the name of Meir Katzin. Meir Katzin, it appears, was a 10th or 11th century pilgrim, probably from Paris, who went to the Holy Land and must have died there a martyr, and somehow his name got associated with this shrine. The truth is, we haven't the faintest idea who was supposed to be buried there. And the only thing we know is that already in the 12th century or 13th century, it is a center like Lourdes, a center like Sedan de Beaupré, a center for Jewish piety, not Catholic piety, a center where cures and miracles take place. And that the one peculiar legend of this shrine is that the mayor, the great Rabbi Meir, who's buried here, the master of the miracle, was a man who was so determined to force the coming of the Messiah that he said, I will not lie down, I will not sit down until the Messiah comes. And so he's buried upright. Now the association of miracles of this holy grave is really the cause of the fact that Tiberias is one of the four holy cities of Israel. As a matter of fact, most of the graves in Tiberias are a little bit suspicious. They'll tell you, for instance, your guide, and wherever you go in this world, guides should be half believed and more than half disbelieved. They'll point to you the grave of the great Moses Maimonides. It's in Tiberias, except that unlike Meir, who died in Turkey, Maimonides died in Egypt. But he was magically, you know, transported to the Holy Land. But, again, his grave is there. It's visited. About a month after Pesach, there's a great procession on the 11th of Iyar in Tiberias of holy folk who believe in these things. from Maimandu's grave to the center of near Baal Hanes, and miracles take place, and prayers are said, and a great time is had by all, even today. That's a strange fate for a city. A city which was, as its name suggests, dedicated to a Roman emperor, Tiberius, the successor of the great Augustus, a man who was known as the durest and gloomiest of all men, a man who has no particular interest in or involvement with Jewish life or Jewish history. In the first century before the Common Era, a family related, from whom Herod ultimately came, family which came to Idumea and was converted for political reasons to Judaism, was given authority in the eastern Mediterranean by the Romans. And Herod's son, Herod Antipas, was given the governorship, the rulership, of a bit of territory which has become, whose geography has become familiar to us in recent years. It included southern Lebanon, the Galilee, the Bekaa Valley, where all those Syrian missile sites have been, and the Golan Heights. And when he took over this territory, Herod Antipas decided that he ought to have several district administrative centers. And so he looked around and he decided that halfway up the western shore of the Sea of Galilee would be a lovely site for a district administrative center which you could visit from time to time, right at the seashore. The climate was salubrious, and he determined to establish a city there. This is the year 21, the Common Era. The walls were dedicated in 21, the community was finished in 29 of the Common Era. And it's the newest of the major city, major holy cities of Israel. And he, being a shrewd courtier, what do? When you create a new city, you dedicate it to the emperor, therefore the name Tiberius. Now the most interesting thing about this holy city is that in its first century, good Jews refused to enter it. They found, as they were putting the foundations of some of the buildings of the city, that Tiberius was mapped out over what had once been a gravesite, a graveyard. Now, in the Bible, there are certain rules which stipulate that if a priest enters a graveyard, he is in a state of ritual uncleanliness. And the Pharisees, those who founded Rabbinic Judaism, enlarged most of the priestly rules so that they involved all of Israel. And for all of Israel, it became the rule, according to the rabbis, the sages, that any touching, any living within a graveyard, or touching of bones, defiles you ritually, made you tamei. And so you do not live in an area which had once been a graveyard until you have removed all of the bones and they have been properly buried. And still today, you'll find from time to time a story coming out of modern Israel. If the archaeologists have struck a cave which is a grave, and the rabbis are picketing because they insist that all the bones in the grave must first be picked out and given proper burial before the archaeologists can in fact continue with their work. In any case, the problem with the ancient graveyards is that unlike Mayfield or a modern cemetery where things are nicely laid out and there's a plot which shows exactly where every grave is, people tended to be buried in caves or hither and yon, and there was really no way of knowing when you had completely decontaminated an area so that religious Jews could live there. Now, establishing Tiberius over this ancient graveyard bothered Herod Antipas not at all, nor did it bother those who were called by this time the Amei Haaretz, the ordinary folk of the country, who had no concern yet with what became the subtleties of rabbinic law. But the scholars and the rabbis did, and they refused to enter this area. And the paradox of all of this is that within 150 years of its founding, Tiberius had become the center of the rabbinic world in the Holy Land and was to remain so for 300 years. that it was in Tiberias that the Mishnah was published. It was in Tiberias that the great Sanhedrin met for the most part over a three-century period. It was in Tiberias that the Patriarchate, the central rabbinic authority of those times, met. Now, how did this reversal take place? And incidentally, one of the things that always interests me about history is what Robert Burns captured when he said, the best laid plans of mice and men of Gangagee. I'm sure if Tiberius had set out a long-range plan for the city, what he would have hoped was that the great Roman baths, which he had established where the statues of Tike and Zeus were prevalent, that the theater, which was part of any Roman theater, a Roman city, that all of these monumental buildings would be embellished and they would become one of the great centers of the Roman world. The last thing he had in mind, I am sure, is that some Jews would come along and take down all the statues of the Roman gods from the city, that they would take the city dedicated to Tiberius and make it into the Jerusalem of their day. How did this happen? Well, three things conspired to make it so. The first, the Jews had always enjoyed going south to Miami for the winter. The second, that Jews have always enjoyed Schwitz baths, that they enjoyed the spas. And the third, the most political of the reasons, that Tiberius escaped most of the damage that occurred to most of the cities in Judea and the Galilee during the two great revolts against Rome. First incident, which has to do with Jews and Schwitz baths. There is a very famous scholar by the name of Simeon Bar Yochai. Simeon Bar Yochai was a contemporary of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Akiba. He was to become later one of the best known mystics of Jewish life. He was assumed to have been a Kabbalist, and the great book of the Jewish mystics, the Zohar, was in fact claimed to have been written in his name. In point of fact, we know very little about Simeon Bar Yochai, except this, that during the Bar Kokhba revolt, the revolt that Bar Kokhba led in between 132 and 135 of the Common Era, which had its final defeat at Matsada, that during this period, Simeon Bar Yochai was an ardent rebel, that the Romans put a price on his head, that unlike Rabbi Akiba, who was captured and executed, Bar Yochai managed to evade the Romans who were chasing him, that he lived for, some say, as much as 14 years in caves in the wilderness, trying desperately to survive. And when finally the rebels against Rome were pardoned and were safe to come out of hiding, this man who'd lived, the scholar who'd lived in the dank and the cold of these caves in the wilderness, probably in the hills someplace, came out crippled with arthritis. And Tiberias is known for its hot springs. So what did he do? He went to the Schwitz. And he sat there with the heat, and slowly the arthritis began to leave from his aching bones, and he was very grateful to Tiberias. And as they talked, as you will talk as you sit in the Schwitz, he discovered the old problem of living within the city walls and being a shrewd man. He put his mind to work at how to clean up Tiberias of its ritual contamination. And looking around, poking around, he realized that the topsoil in Tiberias is very shallow, perhaps an inch or so. And below that, for the most part, the land is gravel and friable stone. And so he said, I'll tell you how we'll do it. We'll manage. We'll plant seeds of plants which have very deep roots. And wherever the seeds do not grow, flourish, you'll know that the land has not been touched. And wherever the seeds do flourish, wherever a plant grows out, you'll know that the roots have been able to reach down into some soft soil. Somebody's cut into that area. And if you dig up those areas and you clean them out of whatever bones you find them, I'll declare the city of Tiberias Tahor, clean. And so they did. And so Tiberius was cleaned up, not in the sense of the cleanup of a modern city, but as rabbis clean up cities. And it was ready for serious Jewish settlement. It escaped, as I said, the depredations, the destructions, for the most part, of the war. It was a salubrious climate, and it was a natural place for the rabbis to come to establish their schools when they could no longer do so further south in Judea and Samaria, because the weather there is far better than in the pestilential swamps of the valley of Jezreel. The Romans controlled the coastlands. This was an area off the beaten track where they could live with some degree of peace. And if you go to Tiberias, you'll recognize that the weather is very much like Miami. Palm trees, subtropical, the kind of life that Jews in their upper years tend to enjoy. So in the second century, by about the year 150 or 160 of the Common Era, Tiberias becomes the center of intellectual rabbinic life. It's there, as I said, that the Mishnah is published. It's there and in several surrounding communities that the great yeshivas met of Palestine, in which the discussions took place, which now comprise the bulk of the material in the so-called Palestinian Talmud. There are two great Talmudic compilations, one Babylonian, one Palestinian. It was, in other words, the great center of Jewish intellectual and cultural life in Palestine during the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and early 5th centuries. And then, of course, as the Christian church became the established church of the Roman Empire and the churchmen were able to get their way more and more with the Byzantines in Constantinople, any kind of rabbinic presence was opposed. And Tiberias, being the great center of Jewish life, was particularly opposed, and the church put the screws on Tiberias. They forced the Jews little by little out. They cut off their means of support, and by the 6th century, Tiberias settled down into being just another small town in which a few Jews happened to live. But interestingly, it remained throughout those centuries a rather creative center. One of the great poets and hymnists of the our tradition, a man named Eliezer Kalir, who lived in the 7th century, was born, lived, and spent his years, his creative years, in Tiberias. And in the 9th and 10th century, Tiberias was the center of a circle of grammarians called the Masoretes, who produced the critical edition of the Bible, which is still the accepted critical edition to this very day. It is the Masoretes who determined what spelling a word should have, the division of sentences in the Bible, the punctuation, the stroke, the stresses that biblical reading should have. And their work, which culminated in something which is known as the Ben Asher Codex, their work produced a text, a handwritten text, which was the accredited, accepted text of the Bible, and remains so for Jewish life down to today. So Tiberias has a noble place in our the development of our intellectual and cultural tradition. The Crusades did Tiberias no good, as they did no good to most of the cities in that area. And during the first half of the second millennium, that is from about the end of the Crusades to the 14th or 15th or 16th century, Tiberias remained a relatively ruined site, for the most part empty of people. And then interestingly, outside of the great graves which continued throughout those years to attract pilgrims, Tiberias enjoyed a revival, a very brief one. But a revival which was, in many ways, the prototype of modern Zionism. Let me give you a little bit of history. The Jewish community in Spain, during the centuries we've been talking about, was the great, powerful, wealthy, intellectually developed Jewish center in the world. But unfortunately, in 1492, when the two great kingdoms of Spain of Castile and Aragon were united through the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella. The church was able to gain a ruling from the royal house that all Jews must either convert or within 6 months leave the country. The poor, for the most part, left. The rich, for the most part, converted, and they became the Muranos, whom you know of our history. Some tried to find a halfway point. Portugal is very Spanish, but had not yet imposed an exile, and many of the rich fled for a few years to Portugal. But in 1498, the church was able to force the king of Portugal to put through a similar decree. Now, among those who fled, the rich, who fled from Spain to Portugal, was a family known as the Nassi family. And there was a woman named Dona Gracia Nassi. The name, she was a very wealthy and very lovely woman, a very energetic one. And she married a man named Mendes, who came from the other great wealthy family of the time. And she and he really controlled in the way they were known, the way the Rothschilds are known in the 19th century, was the wealthy Jewish family of the day. As a Murano, Dona Gracia was known as Beatrice de Luna. And she and her husband lived for a while in Portugal, and then they went up to Antwerp, where there was the center of their banking. Then they went to Venice. And finally, they fled from Venice and reconverted to Judaism, and they went to live in Constantinople. During the same period of time, the early 16th century, the Mamluks who had ruled the Middle East had been overthrown by the Turks. And the Turks in those early years were very shrewd business folk, and they recognized that among these Muranos who had been forced, who were leaving as fast as they could from Spain and the great Spanish Empire, were first of all men of great wealth, and second of all, people of great skill in all of the professions, in literature, and most of all in banking and in trade. And they encouraged the movement of these Jews, these ex-Jews, these Muranos, into Turkey and the Turkish Empire, because they saw them as agents, as catalysts in the economic development of their empire. And of course, being the most important of the families, Beatrice de Luna, now Dona Gracia, was welcomed in Constantinople. Her husband unfortunately died, but her son-in-law, a man named Yao Miguel, whose Hebrew name was Joseph, took over the great family empire, and he became one of the most important people in the Turkish court. An interesting thing happened psychologically among the Muranos, that is, among the group of Muranos who were able to get out and who were able to reconvert to Judaism. And that is that they suffered a terrible sense of guilt for having once been Christian. And it developed among them the piety that if they could only be buried in the Holy Land, somehow that fact of having returned physically to their origins and remaining there until the resurrection would free them of any sense of guilt, any sentencing by God. And so large numbers of these ex-Muranos lived only to be buried in the Holy Land. And Dona Gracia buried her husband there, and then she made plans for her own burial. And she decided that she wanted to be buried in Tiberias, in part because there was a pious tradition that the resurrection would begin in Tiberias 40 days before it began anyplace else in the Holy Land. And we don't know quite how that tradition began, but it's nice to know you'll have 40 more days than anybody else. It probably has something to do with the fact that Tiberias is the lowest city in the Holy Land outside of Jericho, and Jericho was not part of the Jewish world during the Middle Ages. In any case, she was not about to go to Miami without having a lovely house to go to. So she told Joseph, her son-in-law, she wanted a palace built in Tiberias where she could live out her age. She knew it was Miami. And then she would be buried there. And besides that, she wanted him to bring to Tiberias a number of the holy men from Sfat so they could study and pray and guarantee that she would get what she wanted in the next world. She deserved it, by the way. Her money, more than anything else, organized the underground tavern, which brought thousands and thousands of Muranos out of Europe to then the relative freedom of the Eastern Mediterranean. Her money was such that when the city of Ferrara burned 25 Muranos at the stake, she organized a boycott of Ferrara through the Turks, which almost bankrupted the town. She was able to get even for many of the crimes which were being done against her people. She was a great woman. Now, Joseph Nasi was the first modern Zionist. Donna Gracia is still an old-fashioned lady. You go to the Holy Land to die. He had this commission. He would carry it out. He thought to himself, there's a problem. What's the problem? The problem is that there's this tremendous group of refugees who are coming out of Spain and Portugal and the lowlands and Italy, because this is now the 1560s and 70s, and the Counter-Reformation is set in the church, and the church has turned from being a place, the Vatican areas have turned from being a place where Jews could live with relative security to ones which were now places of great danger for Jews. And Jews were coming to the East. What was to be done with them? If too many of them pile into Constantinople or Salonika, they'll create problems. There won't be enough jobs. The community won't be able to support them. They'll create tensions with the locals. Why not find a piece of land which is empty? Why not find a piece of land where Jews can develop their own economy and be masters, relative masters of their own fate? Tiberias was in ruins. The whole area around the Sea of Galilee was not used for anything. He recognized that the Turks would not at all be adverse to having a friendly group of people in that area as a buffer against the Bedouins who would from time to time raid up through the area into the underbelly of Turkey itself. And so he went to Suleiman, the emperor in Constantinople, and he agreed to pay a certain sum of money if the emperor would give him a firman, a writ, which would allow him to reestablish the walls of Tiberias, to bring down drafts of Jews to Tiberias to settle the land. And he told this Suleiman and his heir apparent Murad that he saw a basis for a new economy. They would be textile oriented. They would grow this silkworm in the area. The silk was a very precious commodity. The area is very conducive to silk cultivation. As a matter of fact, silk had been grown there for some years during the 3rd or 4th century. He would reestablish that silk industry, and Turkey would benefit. The Jews would have a home. The Jews would be able to control their own destiny. The refugees would no longer be refugees. They would be Zionist pioneers. This would be the issue. In 1558, he received the firman. He was afraid to leave the court. If you're a powerful courtier, you don't go far from your emperor. So he sent his most trusted lieutenant with a draft of Jews down to Tiberias. And in a matter of a year, they had a wall 2 miles long completed. They had established the first synagogue. Donna Gracia's palace was well underway. And the silkworm was being cultivated in the area. And you, of course, know what happened. An area which no one had wanted, suddenly everybody needed. The Pope interfered within a year. The papal legate in Constantinople went to the Grand Porta and complained that the Jews, one, had destroyed an old Crusader church, which had been destroyed for 500 years, and that they couldn't be trusted, and besides that, they were enemies of the faith. A local sheikh said and published the fact he discovered an old book in which some this Muslim saint had written that if the walls of Tiberias are reestablished by the Jews, Islam will fall. And the Muslims took this to the Muslim court in Constantinople, and they used it as evidence that the Jews must not be allowed to continue. It cost Joseph a lot of money to handle these affairs, but he was in, to use the vernacular, tight with Suleiman and Murad, and for about 30 years, his plans went ahead. And they faltered, interestingly, in a way that many of the early Zionist plans faltered, in the way suggested by the Torah portion that I read to you this morning. The Jews were as much at fault as the enemy. Why? Well, look at Zionism. For every Jew who was willing to leave Tsarist Russia and the pogroms to go to the Holy Land, 1,000 came to the United States. Almost every Jew voted against Zionism with his body. He went elsewhere. The Maranos of Joseph's day, they didn't want to go to the provinces, to this little inland city of Tiberias where there was no culture, there were no libraries, there was no theater, there was no orchestra, only hard work and fields to cultivate. They wanted to stay in Constantinople, in Salonika, in Izmir. They wouldn't go. And of every Jew who did go during the 1890s and 1900s and 1910s to Palestine to cultivate the land, for every two Jews who went, one returned within 2 years to Europe. It was too tough. It was too difficult. When the Bible says that the Hebrew slaves were afraid for Moses to go to Pharaoh with demand to free the people, b'kotzer ruach, because of the narrowness of their spirit, they were describing, it was presaging something which is true about human spirit generally. We are creatures of habit. We are really afraid to try different kinds of living. We are afraid to be part of the new experiments. What saved modern Israel is that the pogroms were so universal and so consistent, most importantly, that so many places we wanted to go closed their doors to us, and we couldn't go there, that we had no alternative. That didn't happen in the 16th century. In a strange, paradoxical way, which we prefer not to think about, it was the 1924 immigration laws in the United States which established quotas. Quotas which were designed to preclude large numbers of people coming in from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, where Jews live. It was the quotas which Canada and England and other countries had, which precluded further Jews from piling in as they had up to that time to these places, which made it inevitable that enough Jews would go to Palestine for there to be a viable Jewish state. Palestine exists to a large degree, Israel exists to a large degree, because of the anti-Semitism of the West. And I speak not of Hitler now and Stalin. I speak of the quota immigration systems of the free nations of the West. Not so much because of the courage of the Jewish people. The people who went there had tremendous courage. But most went to the Golden Medina. They went to convenience. They went to comfort. They went to civilization. They went to the big city. And we're still doing that in many ways. Well, after about 30 years, as things happened, there was not yet a sufficient number of Jews in Tiberias to really allow the economy to be substantial, to cultivate the fields and to have the industry which needed to be there. The local Arabs did exactly what the local Arabs did in the Middle East in the 20th century. They began to attack first the outskirts of the settlement, then the settlement itself. Joseph died, and no one was quite as interested in this particular experiment as he had been before. And by around 1600 or 1610, this noble early Zionist experiment went the way of all flesh. And Tiberias settled back to being a holy city, a city of graves and of pilgrims. In the 18th century, Hasidic groups came there. In the 19th century, some more of the pious of Eastern Europe came there. And then in the 20th century, Tiberias began to have its modern dress, which is a much more Zionist one, largely because it was the only viable city east of the Valley of Jezreel and within the area of the Galil. And so it became the great market and transport center for those communities. And because the young farmers, the chalutzim in the moshavot and the kibbutzim of the area, wanted to be able to go swimming, they wanted to be able to relax from time to time, it became the early Eilat of Israel, these resort town for the farmers, the young pioneers, and it retained that particular tradition to this day. You visit Tiberias today, you'll find it a city of which is lovely, architecturally of no particular distinction. It is on the shores of the lake, you can enjoy the lake. The ruins are Crusader and later. And what they will not tell you is that the old Jewish tradition is still believed by many. That the resurrection will begin with Tiberias, and so that if you really want to have 40 days on the rest of us, arranged to be buried not in Mayfield, but on the outside of Tiberias, and I'll see you 40 days later.